Good morning, Mel. How are you?
Hi.
Well, where do we start? Alleged famine conditions in Gaza. You've always been someone who's been keen to even up the balance with the Israeli portrayal of things, which may or may not be the general public mood, misled or otherwise. What's your take on the current situation?
It's just so difficult to know what the truth of the matter is. And I mean, clearly, if the tales that are coming, which is of Israeli soldiers firing on people waiting for food, and indeed a blockade of food getting into Gaza, then that is clearly a war crime and way over the top and could not be, nobody could do anything but condemn it hugely. But on the other hand, some journalists yesterday were taken in to show apparently vast stockpiles of food within Gaza, which hasn't been distributed as yet. There are certainly what seem to me some fairly persuasive examples of they're calling it is it Gaza wood they're calling it or something of that nature, or Pallywood, that's what they're calling it, where films are being faked. There's a lot of pictures of some what look like very well-fed mothers with apparently starving babies, and you wonder, well, you're clearly not having any difficulty with getting food, but your baby apparently is. And a regular flow of things which come from different conflicts altogether, which are portrayed as coming from Palestine. And it's just, I think, impossible to work out what's happening. They always say the first casualty of the war is truth. And there are powerful propaganda urges and motives behind IDF to play anything down, and on one side, and Gaza and UNRWA on the other side, trying to play anything up. So just this last couple of weeks, I've just become increasingly unable to get any sort of handle on what's actually happening on the ground. And of course, that's the vital thing. But what is very clear is that the treatment of Jewish people across Europe and the US and farther is getting very, very worrying indeed at the moment. The anti-Semitism now does seem to have become mainstreamed into the intellectual left in a way that it hasn't been in my lifetime, and that's a very worrying aspect of the whole matter. But it's a nightmare. Clearly, like everybody else, I would wish that Israel lives in peace with Gaza and the West Bank, as it does with Jordan, which has actually been very helpful to Israel in with sending some of the attacks from the from Hezbollah and others. Israel and Egypt have lived in peace for decades now. The peace between within most of the Middle East, where the world's single Jewish state could live side by side with the Muslim states in the area and others. And that's what we would aim for. And really, unless and until something very serious is done about Iran and its various proxies, it's very difficult to see how Israel could ever feel confident that an October the 7th wasn't always just around the corner, waiting to happen again. But it's a
Thanks.
horrible situation. And of course, all the civilians who are affected on both sides or all sides. It's a tragedy.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to Iran in a moment, Mal, if we could. But I suppose some might say that Israel, first of all, has explicit territorial ambitions of a specific nature, including Gaza and one or two other places nearby, and has been prosecuting this consistently for decades. Second thing is that the allowance of the potential for these optics to arise in itself isn't perhaps going to do any favors in terms of public opinion. And of course, the end game of this, there is, I think, somewhere some sort of doctrine that suggests that there is a five-stage process to the attempts to, as it would say, I suppose, correct the situation in Gaza from the Israeli point of view, and this is it, the end stage is indeed supposed to continue and contain an element of starvation.
Well, I mean, on the first point, I just simply don't understand why Israel would have entirely withdrawn from Gaza. in 2005, to the extent of forcibly removing Jewish people from Gaza, and set up what, it, to all intents and purposes, was a Palestinian state in the Gaza Strip. And that doesn't, it, Israel has never, it seems to me, been wanting to expand its borders. The Golan Heights, which were disputed, were handed back. The West Bank is problematic because it's the geography of the area makes an attack from the West Bank of the River Jordan a very difficult thing to deal with. And I think the there have been concerns, I think justified concerns, about Israeli behavior in the West Bank for many years, and that needs to be looked at. But as far as Gaza goes, until the recent statements, which have been very, chilling from the Israeli government about wanting to take over control of the whole strip. But to look at it from Israel's point of view, they tried it. They handed complete autonomy over to Gaza. They've actually been providing water and electricity at highly subsidized prices into Gaza for decades, for nearly two decades. And yet, the response they got for that was that the money which was being poured in, a significant proportion of it, didn't go to making Gaza the next Kuwait or Abu Dhabi, which they could have done. They could have been enormously wealthy. But an awful lot of that money went into building the terror tunnels, to building armaments, which they could fire on Israel on a regular basis. And then, of course, tooling up for the atrocities of October the 7th. And we should never forget the hostages who are still kept in the area. And it seems to me, if Hamas, as a start, simply handed back all of the hostages, that would work very strongly, it seems to me, in their favor at a PR point of view, because then one of the main, and justified arguments of Israel for the actions has been the situation of these hostages who were so brutally taken and who genuinely have been starved for the last nearly 2 years now. I mean, there's no doubt for most who have come out to the dreadful conditions they're being kept in. And
That's true on both sides.
in terms of the international battle, I'm afraid that anti-Semitism goes so deep. And there was a tweet going around saying that that the left weren't using Israel as an sorry, they weren't using anti-Semitism as an attack on Israel. They were, I can't remember which way around it was, sorry, but the argument was basically that this wasn't a matter of anti-Semitism developing because of Israel. It was that the actions were an excuse for the anti-Semitism that was already there to break out. I'm afraid it's the monstrous things that are going on in Syria at the moment, in Nigeria, the Uyghur Muslims in China, the Kurds, the Yazidis, the most horrendous things going on around the world at the moment, the Druze in Syria being massacred. And this isn't in response to a military threat. This is simply destruction and murder of people who the regime in Syria, the new regime in Syria, hate. And that's the fact that this gets pretty much no focus whatsoever. No marches every Saturday about the plight of the Druze or the Kurds or others who have been attacked on a much, much bigger scale than what seems to be happening in Gaza. It's very difficult to explain that unless one recognizes that anti-Semitism seems, for the last 2,000 years, it seems to have been dyed in the wood of certain groups, particularly the extremes, whether it be the extreme right or the extreme left. And that's and it doesn't seem to me that Israel, or I suspect Israel, has come to a view of saying, look, we got out of Gaza, we did all of these things, we worked on peace accords with Egypt. And at the slightest, and when we get attacked in that monstrous way on October 7th, then on October the 8th, before Israel had responded at all, there were big anti-Semitic marches in London and elsewhere. And I don't know where Israel goes at the end of the day. They must obey international law, but equivalently, the international community, and particularly the left, has shown absolutely no inclination to try and shore up Israel's position and make all of this violence unnecessary.
Well, as I say, I can see how the optics of this, particularly if you've come relatively late to the table, you're speaking as a historian as well, very much look as if Israel is the bad guy, particularly with the humongous nature of their commercial defense industries and the occasional somewhat inappropriate reference to popping missiles into Gaza as mowing the lawn. The vernacular is in their favor, I think, in a sense, and that's the mentality that informs the IDF is not dissimilar to that in late stage Vietnam, but something of that nature. The psychology of this, the amount of traumatized conscripts as well, and on the Israeli side is also an issue. What they've been finding themselves ordered to do. So, Graham, I suppose we're here. And I think he's off on his holes at the moment. Would say that the solution is partly psychological, but a sort of step down, as it were, a redaction of testosterone, perhaps.
Well, it seems that there was that peace or moves towards a genuine ceasefire between the two sides was developing quite helpfully. And then suddenly you got this letter from the collection of Western governments attacking Israel. And Hamas backed down. They said, hang on, why should we've got the world supporting our actions here, that why should we make any sort of concession? Now, it seems that one of the terms that Hamas is making is that all of those who were involved in October the 7th and were captured should be released as part of a peace deal. Now, that's completely unacceptable. If we were the country which had just been attacked in that sort of way, and we were responding, to the saying in Germany, and then Germany in the Second World War turned around and said, "Look, we want you to release you post-war. We want you to release all of those who've been taken to the Nuremberg trials. We want them back as a price for us stopping a war that we started." I just don't see how that can be anything but a PR ploy. I've never really felt all along that Hamas wanted the war to end. Their attitude towards their own people, and there do seem to be plenty of documented examples here of Hamas attacking their own people for, say, taking food from the food convoys that have been coming through, with because there does seem to be quite a bit of sort of a mafia style Hamas operation taking total control of the food supplies that are coming into the country. A whole string of those sorts of reports coming back from what seemed to be pretty reliable sources. I just don't know how Israel's response, and certainly some of the words that are now coming from the Israeli government, are horrendous and clearly shouldn't be happening. But goes back to saying that on the ground, does Israel, basically, what the Jews have been expected to do over the centuries is from time to time just to roll over and allow things to happen to them. If there had been a properly armed Israel at the outbreak of the Second World War, then far, far fewer Jews would have died in the Holocaust. And I'm sure that, well, that must be right at the center of any thinking of any Israeli government. And what they, what we would all like to see is that they temper that anger and fear with a remembering always that the children, the Gazan children, are children just like children from anywhere else in the world. But I must say, I still this just still reeks of old time anti-Semitism and the pogroms and Holocaust and various names that have been given it over literally millennia.
Well, I won't blame it as a conspiracy theory, but there was that rumor, shall we say, wasn't there, that the Rothschild family backed both sides of World War II, but and not Swindon Town, for example. Anyway, Leonie, good morning.
Morning.
We started in, and thank you very much for your forbearance last week. I literally fell asleep as I was pressing the send button. It didn't quite go, so apologies. Anyway, Gaza, a mess, but Malcolm suggests that there may be some AI and optics going on with regard to the famine. What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, who knows? Because nobody's being allowed in, are they?
Apart from a bunch of mercenaries distributing food, we're told. Not UNRWA. UNRWA apparently are fainting on the job for lack of nutrition, but yeah.
I mean, there's been so little food going in, though, since March when the ceasefire was, broken. I do think it's more likely that it is people starving than, some sort of creation, artifact or something like that. And it would appear that Netanyahu and his cohorts don't care. I mean, they really don't care, do they? And they haven't cared since the 7th of October.
What about the SNP, I think it was? Was it Swinney asking in Parliament just before the recess whether that we are going to launch under Starmer a humanitarian drive to sort out what's happening to the kids or what's allegedly happening to the kids?
I don't know. It wouldn't have been Swinney because he's in the Scottish Parliament rather than in...
I beg your pardon. It was the leader of the SNP in the UK Parliament, wasn't it? Yeah.
In Westminster. I mean, the real key to actually stopping them doing anything at all is, of course, the Americans. And I think if Trump hadn't won the election, I don't think they would be behaving quite as they are. It's definitely changed after Trump got into the White House. Obviously, the Americans have been backing this new Gazan Humanitarian Foundation that's been doing
the
this
alleged mercenaries,
doing this new style of food distribution that doesn't really appear to be working.
Some would say giving people food and then shooting at them, but or
well,
vice versa.
But it would seem that is the case.
No.
I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is just awful. And then the vote in the Knesset just this last week to annex the West Bank. So, I mean, given what kind of a state Gaza is in now, and it definitely is because, there's satellite footage of the amount of destruction, isn't there? And given that they're just piling more and more settlers into the West Bank and virtually the whole of the Knesset just voted to annex it completely. Two-state solution, anybody?
Yeah.
There's nowhere for a second state to be, is there?
This chap from Led by Donkeys, who unfurled a mural, a photographic mural of the said destruction, and was arrested for doing so, I think, if I remember right, or at least detained. So there is also the optics of this that is, in terms of policing, we are in a somewhat confused state, it seems to me. And this is a judicial review of whether that organisation we can't name can be named.
I don't think it's whether or not they can be named.
I'm told it is by Ofcom, but yeah, I can't even mention the word, or I'll be carted off.
Well, I thought it was people holding up banners that said, I support them.
Indeed, the same applies.
I mean, I think you'd also be arrested if you held up a banner that said, I support Hamas.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, there are a number
That's
of...
That's also true, yes.
Yeah, so, I don't know about this banner with the mural. I mean, presumably there was some other element that created the need to take action. I mean, there does seem to be... I can see why the government was exercised about the group that's just been prescribed, because they caused almost 10 million quid's worth of damage.
So an American leased plane to the RAF.
Well.
What a faux pas. That was, yeah.
But I certainly And people have said, oh, it's like Greenham Common. Well, no, because the camps at Greenham were committed to non-violent direct action, and they never ever at any time went inside the American base. So it was very much lying down and not doing anything.
That's true. And in the long run, just as effective. I remember one of my former colleagues in Newbury was one of the Greenham women. She was feisty, I think is an okay word to use, and proud of that particular period of service. But, the hard yard, certainly.
So it is possible to get your point across without causing 10 million quid's worth of criminal damage.
It is. I mean, just as a point in any situation, this is unfortunate, isn't it? But it's the fact that people have reached that point, and optics have reached the point that they've reached, where there's a sort, almost a certain desperation about this, isn't there?
There is a certain amount of desperation, but there's also a certain amount of performative anger because people must know, and that's why, people shouting at me that Keir Starmer's got blood on his hands and other choice remarks.
They've done so, have they, on social media and elsewhere?
Oh yes, I mean there's a woman who was a Labour councillor in Merton who put on social media that, well, two things actually, both of which were quite offensive. One was that Keir Starmer has blood on his hands, and the other one is that all Jews are paedophiles,
Well,
which
that's just
is
insane, isn't it? But it does.
yeah,
I
so
suppose the word Epstein, which has been rather is becoming rather prominent in our headlines, must have come to their minds.
I think, well, I don't know what came into her mind. Anyway, not surprisingly, she's no longer sitting as a Labour councillor. She's not even a member of the Labour Party anymore, as you would anticipate. But so people, I mean, I think people are lashing out. People want the government to do something.
And
Perhaps
they
the
won't do
government,
it, evidently.
well, even if the government had completely disinvested every last pound or shekel from Israel, even if everything that the British government had been doing had been to the maximum, and I don't know how much that is or is not true that they are still selling arms to Israel or anything like that, it still wouldn't stop Netanyahu from doing what he's doing. And this is the problem, is that you can jump up and down about what everyone else is saying, but Netanyahu would still be carrying on because he's got the backing of the Americans.
And RAF planes, albeit leased by the Americans to us, which perhaps is part of the deal, I don't know. So the end game is literally when he runs out of ammunition, which is not anytime soon.
The end game is when the Americans when Trump finally realizes that actually they're not going to stop, and there's, but he can make them stop. And they will only stop if the Americans make them stop. And that is the only game in town, really.
I was on the tram yesterday, and a very astute young mum said to her small person, "Are you going to behave or not behave?" And there were two. She clearly had the riot shields and the wheels on the bus in reserve there. But that, I thought that's the stark thing that sometimes had to be said to politicians, doesn't it? Or
But the problem is, of course, that and it's I appreciate what Malcolm was saying about the sort of historical context, but the context here is to do with Netanyahu himself, isn't it? And he doesn't want the war to stop.
What do you make of the psychology of the man, Mal? He seems to be permanently embattled, as I see him. But how do you see him?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. It seems to be growing. Protest in Israel about Netanyahu. Of course, there was before the war. It's one of these ironies that Netanyahu was in very, very considerable political trouble before October the 7th.
Well, you say ironies, it's a get out of jail card, presumably, isn't it, amongst other things, or
Oh yeah,
was.
and this sort of often happens is that, and yeah, whether he wants the war to continue is I don't know, but it's certainly undeniable that in terms of his political standing within Israel, the war has so far worked in his favor. And Israel has this electoral system that is its proportional representation. There is a 5% limit on when parties can get seats in the Knesset, but its politics have been dogged by the difficulty of creating stable coalitions for a long time. And Netanyahu is as yeah, with many, you don't get to that position without having a considerable number of skills, and in particular, skills of building a team around you who will support you. Yeah, politically, obviously, he's been extremely successful. He's become prime minister of the country. But in an electoral system that sometimes makes moderation more difficult. But I keep going back and saying, how do you respond moderately to what happened to Israel on October the 7th and the ongoing hostage situation? I don't know what a moderate response to that would look like, really. I can't imagine
Well,
that if
there was
you
negotiation, there's no Doha on and off with Witkoff
But how do you negotiate with
and
another party which has as its first its first article the destruction of Israel and death to the Jews? And how do you compromise from someone who wants to kill all Jews and someone who doesn't want any Jews killed? Do you say, right, we'll kill half of the Jews, in which case, which half do you choose? I don't know what compromise looks or moderate response
In
looks
words of
like.
an
And genuinely, that's, I just don't know what an appropriate response, given that an appropriate response would have to be a successful response in as far as possible preventing October the 7th from happening again, when Hamas have managed to build up the next generation of tunnels and weapons and intelligence to do that. And so, yeah,
It's an extraordinary thought.
one can
Given the
hate,
scale of destruction.
one can, have, be reviled by Netanyahu. I think I am by many of the things that have gone on there, but at the same time, not really have a clear alternative in mind. Which goes back to, what we were saying right from the start, is that I'm just completely confused about the situation, how it might move forward.
And that's not something that's often the case, Mal. Let's pause that there. It's not on the agenda, but I wonder if we could talk about the formal declaration of the establishment of a rise, jointly led by Zarah Satala and Jeremy Corbyn, who claimed yesterday, or somebody claimed on his behalf, that upwards of 500 people a minute are signing up to this enterprise, which aims. This is where Mal, the pathologist, I think will be particularly helpful. Thank you. 25%. Percent of the vote. Now, is that going to split matters? Are they going to be a significant political force? Or is it effectively a party of protest, not just about Gaza? And you might suggest that anti-Semitism might come into the mix in some form, Mal, but also about the state of where we are after a year of Starmer.
There's a fascinating podcast series on Radio 4 called Post-War, and it focuses on the period, the basically the Attlee Churchill election of 1945, and looks at a variety of issues around that. And just one statistic in one of them, it says that in the 1945 election, over 90% of people voted for either Conservative or Labour. And in 2024, that was around 40%. And this is, we're in uncharted territory. So I've said several times, I think the normal pattern of alternating Labour and Tories, so the Tories come in and put the economy right, Labour come in and make sure that the people, the
Grimm's
weak
third
get
law.
held back and money gets spent on public services. And then, as Liam Byrne says, the money runs out. We need the Tories back in to be a bit hard-nosed for a while, get the economy going again, and then we can have Labour back to invest again. And over cycles, that's been pretty successful in terms of producing a country where there are very few people, or certainly, the diminishing numbers of people who were in desperate need, but an economy also where entrepreneurship was rewarded. Now, partly because of the subprime crisis and then the epidemic and then the energy crisis and then Ukraine, there was a whole string of things that happened just before and during the Conservative years between 2010 and 2024, which meant that the economy that was inherited by Labour was in a much worse state than, say, it was in 1997 after the major Clark years, when the economy was in an extremely good state, which has meant that Labour hasn't got the resources to do what they're having to govern like Conservatives. They're having to keep a very close eye on the finances, whereas, say, in 1997, when Blair and Brown came in, Brown was able to run, an expansionist public state because the economy was delivering at the time. And the response to this is that, well, we don't like the Tories because they didn't do their job of making the economy run, and all the stuff we know about Johnson and the Liz Truss debacle.
Bit of creaming off, to say the least, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now we've got Labour, which is talking about cutting winter fuel allowances and putting the pension age up hugely, and all of those strings of things, and the benefits row, the traditional Tory base is disillusioned with the Tories and looking elsewhere. The traditional Labour base is disillusioned with Labour and looking elsewhere. And we're seeing the most extraordinary fractiousness, disintegration almost of the political system which has governed the country for literally centuries, really since the emergence of the Whigs and the Tories in the 18th century. So it's uncharted territory. The main beneficiary of a new left-wing party will be the parties on the right. I'd have guessed that of all the political leaders rubbing their hands this morning, it's Nigel Farage who's the happiest of them all. But I reckon the Tories will be pretty happy as well. Because under a first-past-the-post system, almost all of the votes of a new Corbyn party will come from Labour, I would guess. I can't imagine a great number of Tories or Reform UK moving into that area. Interestingly, yesterday Reform picked up another couple of seats, by-election seat, one from Labour, one from Tory.
They win some, they lose some. They win some.
Well, what seems to be is once they've been elected, if they go to a by-election, they lose it. And we've seen a small number, but in every case where Reform candidates had resigned a few weeks after being elected in May. And they've lost every one of those by-elections because maybe when people see them actually close up, they're less attractive. But equivalently, they are by far the most successful party in by-elections over the last year or more. Now, they're big enough that they've now got their own group at the Local Government Association, the first new group to be formed since the independent group was formed.
Really?
Yeah, and there is now...
The same people are showing up every week.
I don't know how
speaking.
This is very new because it's only since May. But the Local Government Association is organised along, understandably, along party lines, but working in committees cross-party. And it does, generally speaking, I think it does a pretty good job. But there will now be separate Reform UK representation, including, presumably, chairs of some of the committees because they share the chairs out. The scrutiny is going to be much more on them because there's now actually something to scrutinise. And the same will be the case if a new Corbyn-led party, which already Corbyn and Zara Sultana seem to have fallen out about the name and the like. But one of the things that is endemic within parties of the far left and far right is that they hate each other far more than they hate people in the centre. So you're seeing Reform already has lost two of the six MPs it's had elected in Parliament, one of which just because of what seems to be a personal falling out between Farage and his former colleague.
They seem to thrive on this, don't they? This sort of, cosplay of aggression.
Because they, at the end of the day, you know, populists don't tend to be terribly serious about governance, and governance is difficult.
That's the thing, isn't it?
You know, The new Labour administration of Wandsworth have found some decisions difficult, but it's serious-minded and it wants to, it recognises that and recognises the mistakes we've made. The far left and the far right are so used to being ginger groups and pressure groups and shouting from the sidelines that if the political system collapses and they actually end up in a potential position of power or certainly strong influence, then I'm yet to be convinced that there's enough of them who actually realise that although they're advocating simplistic solutions to complex problems, what will they do when they find out that complex problems often need complex solutions?
Interesting thought, isn't it? I suppose you could say that, albeit very well funded, Reform UK and before that UKIP were effectively a protest party, specifically with their MEP grouping, and it grew like Topsy. Anyway, Leonie, as a stalwart Labour insider for a number of years, how do you react to what Corbyn and Sultana are doing? And do you think it's got legs? And what will it do to the, I suppose, the nap fill of Labour thinking?
Well, I think Zara Sultana should immediately resign because she's no longer Labour
I
and
think she's done so, hasn't she?
no,
Oh, okay.
resign as
Right.
an MP
Oh, I see. Yes. I beg your pardon. Yeah.
and re-stand again in the by-election. She can be elected to represent her new party if she's going to start from an honest basis because people helped her get elected. Last year, who were Labour people, Labour money was spent on her election, and so on and so forth. So she's currently sitting under false pretenses because she was elected as a Labour person. Corbyn has, obviously didn't stand last year to be elected as a Labour MP, so he truly is an independent, along with a few others who came through the system. I think. I think Malcolm's point about taking votes off Labour, I think more in common who do polling have also looked at where else they might take votes from. And the Greens have been having
Yes.
a massive rise on that side of politics. And one of the things that they've been talking a lot about has been Gaza. As well as net zero and all the other sort of more obviously sort of green topic areas to do with the environment. And so they also think that they will even more heavily than, take a percentage of votes from Labour, but take an even higher percentage of votes from the Greens, who, like Reform, also broke through at the last general election and went from, they'd had one MP. For some years, and they've now broken through and have got four, all of whom are still members of the Green Party, and don't seem to be going through these sort of personality, arguments that the Reform people seem to with each other, and it seems to be a bit of a sort of changing cast of
They might
characters.
massage each other with vine leaves or something rather than pugilism, I suppose. Yeah.
I think what Malcolm was saying about the change in people's voting habits or patterns was really interesting when you saw some of the results from May of this year. And the one that made me really sit up was the one for the West of England mayor, who actually which was actually won by Labour by somebody I know because
Wow.
she used to live in Tooting, called Helen Godwin, and the vote was split almost 20% for five parties. I mean, it was almost 20-20-20-20.
Good
Obviously,
heavens.
it wasn't in the end because someone did actually win. And I think in that situation where someone can win an election with maybe 25% of the vote. Compared to all the others who've all got, 20% plus or minus a few, I think it then becomes incredibly difficult to predict who's going to win anything. And the other parties who were doing well were the Greens, the Liberal Democrats, the Conservatives, Reform, and Labour. And those were the five parties. And that seems to be where politics has gone to at the moment. I think over the last 100 years, over the sort of life of the Labour Party, if you like, the sort of which is only just over 100 years old, there have been moments before when the electoral system looked as though it was going to go into this more fractured place, if you like. I mean, the 1980s, the rise of first the SDP and then the Liberal Democrats once the SDP merged with the Liberals, and they took a fairly large slice in of the sort of centrist vote, I think taking votes from parts of the Labour Party and then parts of the Tory Party, but
Indeed,
they
yeah.
weren't really able to follow through with winning. And I think what's happened is people have understood much more about how to win under first past the post, and you can't just have 20% of the vote everywhere. You need to get concentrations of votes in specific seats. And I think, watching the Greens and Reform, being very assiduous about specific seats in specific places, and frankly, that's what Labour did last year. It was very assiduous in certain seats where it thought it had an opportunity, and then once it realised that that opportunity was secured, probably secured in those seats, it then moved on to another tranche of seats and started working on those ones. And then it actually also won some seats that it probably was sort of icing on the cake, sort of seats that kind of fell into its lap. So there are of the 411 people it originally elected as Labour MPs, I think it's down to 398 now because of various people being suspended for
It's a lot of it about, as Barakra, I would say. Yes, yeah.
for various reasons, let's just say,
Yeah.
the easiest way to say it. It's quite a lot of them have got very, very small majorities. And I can't believe that those people whose majorities are anywhere from, let's say, 500 down to 16, there's one person who's got a majority of 16, there's someone else who's got a majority of 20. I mean, these are incredibly slim majorities. I think those people must surely see themselves as one-term MPs, or most likely one-term MPs. I think the problem that Starmer's got is that a number of other people probably would like to see themselves as being in Parliament for a bit longer than that, whose majorities are bigger, and yet they're seeing the results of by-elections and things like that, and are not very happy at the communication of what Labour is doing has been diabolical, and so there's been this focus on things that are not in line with Labour values, if you like, so the winter fuel allowance or changes to PIT payments and things like that. Labour has actually done a very long list of very good things over the last year, and yet it's not communicating them.
So
And
Angela Rayner made this very point the other day, didn't she? And it's you just don't
yeah,
hear it.
no, you don't. And they need to be much more ruthless on the. I mean, they didn't even have a comms person in Number 10 for a long time. And that was where Blair was really, really good. And in the end,
Just going to say.
the media got fed up with it and invented the term spin doctor and all the rest of it. But Blair had people in Number 10 who were ruthless about making sure that the messages that
Alistair
Blair,
Campbell for one, yeah.
Alistair Campbell, very much in the lead, in the centre of that. And so that is something that Starmer appears unable to master. And so the position is not good. It's not good. And so I think there's another set of MPs who, are feeling nervous and so are expressing their views. And I think the Parliamentary Labour Party appears to be fractious, shall we say. I'm not in it, but it appears to be fractious.
Well, we've been here before, and you've been a very keen observer. Thank you for such a robust reflection of where we're at. I'm
I'd
wondering,
just
in
make a
yes, please.
couple of comments. As I understand it, Zara Sultana was suspended from the Labour Party. And in those circumstances, it's not quite as clear as it might be otherwise that she should resign her seat. I mean, she was elected to the Labour Party member, but then the Labour Party removed the whip from her, and I think that may put her in a slightly different position. I mean, I've got form on this, obviously, and I'm not. I suspect the last thing Labour would want would be a by-election in her seat, which almost certainly she would sweep to victory.
People like Wes Streeting were gone in by a Nats Quaver in Ilford,
well, he won
didn't
by
he?
500,
yeah,
yes,
yeah,
by a
yeah.
majority of 500. But I'm
Starmer's
sure the Labour
sort of
Party hierarchy are
potential
petrified
successor.
that she might resign, like Douglas Carswell did in Clacton, and win a by-election, and that would give enormous impetus to the cause of the new party. It won its first by-election.
Just imagining Cyril Sotalo winning in Clacton. That would be a coup, wouldn't it?
And the Greens are in huge internal difficulties over the gender issue, and
Oh, dear, oh,
really
dear,
tearing themselves apart. There's a large group of the Green Women's Organisation, which I think has now been banned from within the party. There's been a lot of expulsions for people who believe that men and women are men and women, and there's a lot of dislike there. And yes, Leon is absolutely right to point out that the new party would take a lot of its natural support from Greens, who themselves are largely made up of disaffected, or to a considerable extent, made up of disaffected Labour people anyway. I'm always a bit sceptical when parties say we're just not getting our message across, because you tend to hear it when actually the message itself is not terribly attractive. Yeah, the there is no doubting, and I say I don't really blame Labour for this, because the Tories didn't do their job of leaving them the money to spend and invest. But nonetheless, it is it's not miscommunication about the changes to welfare. It's not miscommunication about an enormous Labour rebellion within, basically within the first year of a parliament. Parliaments get fractious after 4 or 5 years, or 3 or 4 years, when people start to look at their seats and wonder whether they can persuade people. But a majority of this size to make a policy that was right at the very heart of the Chancellor's strategy, they couldn't even get that through the House at this stage. That's not a matter of communication. That's a matter of really serious problems within party management and the state of the politics. And it's interesting that there was an exchange between Margaret Thatcher and Frances Pym in 19. Pym was Foreign Secretary at the time, and Thatcher obviously leader of the Tories, just before the 1983 election, where Pym, in a public forum where they were both present, said that he didn't think that landslides were a good thing, generally speaking, in politics. And Thatcher slapped him down and said, no, we want every vote.
Thank you, mother, to see
sorry,
that. Yes.
It's a sorry landslide, so be it. But there's, it's not new that parties target seats and ignore the ones they know they're going to lose. But I do wonder about the strategy of ending up with such a wide and narrow majority, a wide and shallow majority as Labour have at the moment, because there are, as Leonie says, huge numbers of Labour MPs with very small majorities who are going to balk at the idea of supporting any unpopular policy, because if an unpopular policy costs them 200 or 300 votes locally, which is a tiny proportion of the total electorate, but in many cases that could be a huge dent in the majority, or even enough to lose them the seats. So, it's hindsight here, and the electorate will vote the way the electorate votes. They're in charge. But I do wonder whether Labour actually was sensible in getting such a huge majority, where the average, a huge parliamentary majority, where the average majority in the seats was so small. I've been doing some work in another London borough at the moment, which is run by an administration fairly tight. It's actually a mayoral system, but fairly tight. But it's quite likely that come May, there may well be a landslide for the ruling group in that council. And just sort of talking through with Emma, saying this, it's a in many ways a much more difficult job to manage a big majority than it is to manage a small one. Because with a small one, everybody's recognizing they have a lot of breathing down our necks, they're a credible opposition, and we better stick together, even when things are going tough. You get the luxury when you have a huge majority. They only made the point, quite a few Labour MPs are already no longer Labour MPs for a variety of reasons. So I don't know. I think Labour's landslide this time may, with the benefit of hindsight, not like the Blair one in 1997 or the Thatcher ones in 83 and 87, that they continued to manage their parties very effectively in those cases, Labour in 2001. Because there was a cohesion, and actually there was a vision, there was a knowing where people were going. Thatcher came in with the economy in a desperate state. Blair came in with the country needing to
Royal
be
Britannia, Cool Britannia, yeah. Yes,
and both of them, broadly speaking, succeeded in their aims. Because Labour can't afford a vision because they've got the money, then yes. I think that makes things even worse.
Reluctantly,
I think Malcolm, I think you'll find that one of the reasons why people were very exercised about the benefit changes was not just sort of personal viewpoints, is because they'd been out on doorsteps in the lead up to May, and Reform would not have won the Runcorn and Helsby by-election if it hadn't been for the benefit changes, because it came up on the doorstep. It was raised by voters all the time.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure that's right. But there were a lot of things during the Tory years which were very unpopular policies. There always are during Tory years. But nonetheless, the broad wisdom of politics so far has been that carrying through difficult policies early on in your administration, so they've had a chance to bed down, and the good things that you're doing have had a chance to come to fruition that you couldn't do if you hadn't taken those difficult decisions. It is better electoral politics, quite apart from being a better way to run the country.
And that's basically where people think things are at.
The image at the moment is that Labour are whacking up taxes, and already we've seen this in national insurance, and we have this cast iron promise from the Chancellor that she will not raise taxes in the next budget, and we've got to see what comes of that promise. We've got a sense that it's a party that will just flip flop all over the place and has no backbone, and that doesn't do a party any good. And yes, this was a very, very difficult decision, but that's £5 billion of expenditure that was at stake here. That sort of chunk of money doesn't come from chopping a few civil service jobs here and there, or whatever the alternatives might look like. It's got to say, to cut £5 billion off public expenditure, someone's going to hurt a lot. And, she can't continue taxing the rich because they're already beginning to flee the country. She doesn't seem to be able to cut elsewhere. And I don't blame her personally. I think she's probably far closer to
a bit tearful the other day, wasn't she? Yeah.
And you, of course, feel sympathy for that. It must be a dreadful position to be in. So this isn't by any means a personal attack on her. I think she's far closer to economic reality than many of her colleagues. But sometimes in politics, you've got to take tough decisions. And if you are seen, not least by your own backbenchers, as being a party that will roll over if they get a bit of flack, then the next difficult decision gets the flack, and the one after that, and you end up with having achieved nothing and simply made things worse. We're borrowing something of
Malcolm, I think that's why they chose towards the end of the parliamentary session to suspend various people who they felt had been ringleaders in a number of different rebellions. I mean, obviously there were more than just four people who voted against things, but they only suspended four specific MPs who were sort of regularly on the radio talking about their opposition to what the government was supporting. Rachel Maskell, for example, very particularly and extensively talking about the personal independence payment changes that she said she couldn't vote for under almost any circumstances. So they were making examples of people, if you like.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, but that was because they wouldn't support the climb down. After the climb down had finished, had taken place, which was enough. to attract or get the votes of the majority of the party. So, you know, this was people who wouldn't even accept the flip-flop, and it doesn't,
well, no,
I think,
because
change the...
They were suspended for different reasons, because Chris Hinchliffe, I think, was suspended because he was very, very critical of the planning and infrastructure bill. They weren't all suspended for the same reasons. They were seen as the people who were the sort of the outriders for opposition around a number of different topics. So I think, you know, it wasn't just around the welfare situation.
Listening to you both, it does sound very much like, regrettably, I'm going to have to pause this because I have to run to the day job.
Well, I'll just make one final point, is that we're borrowing something of the order of 125 billion a year. Three quarters of that goes on paying the interest on our existing national debt. So three quarters of what we borrow as a country is just going in interest at the moment. That's not sustainable.
That is a thought, isn't it? Well, fraternal
sounds a bit
greeting.
Like Thames water, but that's a whole different topic.
The first being I will see in the day job is a guard cat who looks extraordinarily like Richard Maltling to me. So he sends his kind regards, and I will see you guys next weekend. Thank you very much.
Okay. See you. Bye.